Joseph Tape was just 12 when he left his native Guangdong province in China alone and went to San Francisco. He quickly rose from servitude to become an influential player among the growing numbers of Chinese who came to America immediately following the gold rush. In her new book, The Lucky Ones, historian and Columbia professor Mei Nai traces three generations of the Tape family and their assimilation into the new world. Professor Nye's first book, Impossible Subjects, won the AHA Littleton Griswold Prize and the OIH Frederick Jackson Turner Award. The Lucky Ones is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and I'm very pleased that it brings Mei Nai to our show today. Hello.
Thank you for having me.
Did writing Impossible Subjects lead you to the Tape family?
Actually, it did. I came upon this story for the Lucky Ones when I was researching the first book in the Department of Labor archives in Washington, D.C., and it was one of those things where you find a document that you didn't know you were looking for until you found it. It was a report written in 1914 about Chinese who worked as interpreters for the Immigration Service. And a name jumped out at me from the page, Frank Tape. And Tape is not a Chinese name. And I wondered if he was related to the family in a civil rights lawsuit from the 1880s, Tape v. Hurley, which concerned the exclusion of Chinese from public schools.
And
it was the same family. Yes, he was the brother of the little girl in the lawsuit.
Are the Tapes remembered in San Francisco, in that Chinatown?
I think there are people who know about the civil rights case around the schools because it was a landmark case in the state. Before that, Chinese were not allowed to go to public school. But the paradox of the ruling was that while they were admitted to schools, it was the occasion for San Francisco to set up a segregated Chinese school in Chinatown.
Following the example of what was happening with blacks.
Exactly.
In the South.
Exactly.
How many years does this story cover?
It starts in the late 1860s when the people who are the patriarch and matriarch first come to the United States. They come separately as fairly young age, 11 or 12, and it goes to about 1950.
You describe her background as having been perhaps rather traumatic. Was that typical?
Yes. Well, it was not unusual. She was brought over as an indentured servant as a young girl, probably to work in a brothel and intended for prostitution when she became older. But somehow she escaped from her servitude, and she was raised in the home of the Ladies Protection and Relief Society.
And her English name was Mary.
Right.
So we have Joseph and Mary.
Exactly. Right. And we don't know what her Chinese name was. It was never recorded and she never acknowledged it. So we only knew her as Mary McGlattery, named after the matron who raised her.
And Joseph Tape, how did he wind up with that name?
Well, his Chinese name was Ju Dip. So he might have wanted Joseph to match her Mary. And Ju Dip sounds a little bit like Joe Tape. So that's my theory.
He just came up with an American sounding name. And he seems to have been intent on assimilation.
He was intent on making it. Mm. And that, I think, involved acculturation into American norms.
Well, how did he even wind up being able to pay the passage to come here?
Well,
he was 12 years old.
Right. Most Chinese either had some family collateral against which they could get a ticket on credit. And often that credit, that the debt was paid when they came to America through their family association. So that's probably how he did it.
Do we know much about what his life was like in China?
No, we don't know anything about his life in China, but we do know the village he came from. It was a village called Skipping Stone Village in Taishan Province. And most Chinese during that time came from that village or that area. So we know about the conditions in the area.
From Guangdong, also called Canton, right?
Canton is the city. It's the capital city, Guangzhou, yes.
And he settled in San Francisco, which is where most of the immigrants from Guangdong might have settled?
Well, actually, most of them didn't settle in San Francisco. They come through San Francisco, but they go up to the gold country in the 1860s, or they go work somewhere else. But he wasn't interested in that. He became a house servant for a dairy farmer out on Van Ness, actually where the Symphony Hall stands today.
Weren't anti-Chinese attitudes common when he arrived in San Francisco? Why were whites so, why did they feel so threatened by these Chinese men?
Well, the white people in California in the 1860s and 1870s, many of them had been miners, or they had worked, in areas where there was no longer work. So there was a recession, actually, after the railroad was completed. The railroad brought a lot of things to California, and not all of them were expected. It brought more people. It also brought the Great Depression from the East. It brought higher prices and also lower wages. So there was a lot of economic competition, and Chinese, in a lot of ways, were an easy target because they were considered to be different.
Well, they were working difficult jobs. They were working after they worked on the railroad, they worked in the mines.
Right, and in the cities, they worked in factories and doing all
restaurants,
kinds of
laundries,
all kinds of work. Right, but there's a certain point at which the economic resentment mixed with racism takes on an irrational character, in my view, and they just become a target for people.
My guest is Mei Nai, spelled NGAI. Her book, The Lucky Ones, One Family and the Extraordinary Invention of Chinese America. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. How are they involved in the invention of Chinese America?
What I was trying to show, or what I learned in researching this family, was that they had a particular opportunities that they took. It was at that time, it was virtually impossible for a Chinese to break into what we would call today the primary labor market. You couldn't go work for a white company or a white institution. And the only narrow door one could go through, which is the door that they found, was to work as an interpreter or as a broker, somebody who facilitated transaction between the American institutions and the immigrant community. So Frank Tape was an interpreter for the Immigration Bureau, and in fact his two sisters also married interpreters. Their father was a broker in the immigrant trade. He was a passenger agent for the steamship companies, and he brokered bonds. And so brokering was, I think, an interesting way that people could actually break into the middle class when there was no other way.
In the early days, many Chinese refused to cut their pigtails because life was so tough, they thought that they would eventually wind up going back to China.
Right. Well, it was a required sign of respect to the Manchu dynasty to wear a queue. Mm-hmm. So when a man or a boy cut it, it was in a way making a statement that they intended to stay in America.
Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming Joseph Tape, looking at the pictures, was one of those people who cut it.
Right, right.
In fact, he looks like he decided not to be part of any of the stereotypes that we associate with the Chinese of that time. But then laws start being enacted. We have, you mentioned that they couldn't get jobs with white companies. There was then the Page Act, wasn't there?
The Page Act is 1875. That was really the first exclusion law, which was aimed at contract workers and prostitutes. And it was presumed that all Chinese men were coolies or, you know, indentured in some way, and that all women were prostitutes, when in fact they weren't. So in 1882, they had to pass a more blanket exclusion act against Chinese laborers.
And then Chinese immigrants were forced to pay a monthly tax, weren't they?
Well, Chinese miners had to pay a tax, mm-hmm. a foreign miners tax. Yes.
I would think that a lot of people would have wanted to return to China under these circumstances. How did Joseph Tape eventually meet Mary?
Well, he was, as I said, he worked for a dairy farmer out on Van Ness, and he got promoted, so to speak, from being a house servant to driving the milk wagon. And the home where Mary was raised was just a few blocks away. So I speculate, I think reasonably, that that's how they met, in the same neighborhood.
He wound up becoming a drayman, didn't he? Started
right.
his own business?
Right.
He just saved until he could make enough money to do that?
Yeah, I don't know how he financed getting a horse and a wagon. It might have been a loan that he took out, or he might have just saved up his money. I think he was one of the first, if not the first, Chinese Teamsters in San Francisco.
Did he experience anti-Chinese prejudice as a businessman?
Well, I don't know what his intention was. He might have intended to haul goods generally in the city, but you know, he ended up hauling goods for Chinese merchants, and then he had the inspired idea of moving the baggage for people who got off the boats to Chinatown, and that was actually quite lucrative.
Well, you've called your book The Lucky Ones. Was Joseph lucky, or was he just a smart businessman?
You know, people always say the immigrants are the lucky ones, you know. They're the ones who get to leave. So the people left behind in the village think the immigrants are the lucky ones. And then once they get here, the immigrants see that it's actually a pretty hard row to hoe. So they see the successful ones as being the lucky ones. But it's not so easy for them either. So,
well, he was a successful one. He started acquiring other businesses as well.
Right.
Would they have been considered wealthy by the Chinese community?
Oh, they were wealthy by almost any standard. He owned five houses in Berkeley. He had hunting properties up in Mendocino County. When automobiles were produced in the early 20th century, they had fancy cars.
But you also say the Tape family profited from what you call the legal regime of racial discrimination. You write, their lives were a paradox. They broke into the American middle class by helping manage the continued marginalization of other Chinese.
Right.
I'm assuming that wasn't all that uncommon.
Well, I think that's what's interesting to me about this brokering class of people, that they are in-between people. They're the go-betweens. And because they themselves suffer from discrimination and exclusion, they protest it, but they also make a living from enforcing exclusion. Yes.
And the key thing that they did in 1884, they tried to enroll their daughter Mamie at the Spring Valley Primary School, which was a public school in their neighborhood. And she was not allowed to attend?
No. Every principal in San Francisco was under instruction to refuse admission to Chinese children on pain of dismissal.
So they sued?
They sued.
Now, I would have assumed, considering the sentiment of the time, that they would have lost.
Well, Chinese did not lose every suit they brought. In this case, the reading of the statute was plain. In California, the school law of 1880 was that all children of school age were supposed to go to school.
So Hurley was the principal who had denied them
That's
access?
Right.
Did she just wind up going to that school?
No, actually what happened was when they won the suit, the San Francisco city government rushed through a bill in Sacramento that authorized them to set up a segregated school. So a school was established right on the fringes of Chinatown, and the children had to go there.
And Mary was very upset. She wrote a letter to the local newspaper.
Right, and she swore that her children would never, three exclamation points, never, never, never go to that school that was set up just for the Chinese children. But in fact, they were the first ones at the door when it opened.
Mm-hmm. Well, for all their attempts at integration, weren't Mary and Joseph opposed to the children marrying anyone who wasn't Chinese?
No, they all married Chinese. I think they realized at the time that it was really against all social custom and also illegal for Chinese to marry white people.
Mm-hmm. Did they live in the Chinese community?
No. Well, at first they lived out near Spring Valley School, which was a white area, near Russian Hill.
Was that a problem?
Not in the beginning. I think when they first moved there, there were very few people living there, period. But after a while, it became more settled, and I think it got a little rougher. And they moved closer to the school, so they didn't live exactly in Chinatown, but they lived outside of it. And then they moved to Berkeley.
Well, they won the court case, but in the end, it just led to a segregated school, separate
right.
but equals, so-called.
Right.
Was that a real victory?
Well, I think if, you know, to go from total exclusion to segregation is a measure of progress, but obviously it's not what they wanted and it's not what we would want.
And when did this change in San Francisco? Because the laws, the exclusionary laws, lasted into
World War II.
Yeah.
Right. The exclusion laws don't fall till 1943, and the segregation laws don't really fall until the World War II era.
Really? So Chinese in California or in just in the San Francisco area?
No, Chinese, it's not exactly like the South with Jim Crow. Chinese were not required to all go to segregated schools, but the law authorized school districts to establish them if they wished to. Mm-hmm. So when they moved to Berkeley, their children did not attend segregated schools because Berkeley didn't do that.
May Nye will be giving a lunchtime talk next Thursday, October 7th at 12:30 in the Rose Conference Hall at the Asia Society. For more information about that, you can visit our show page at WNYC.org. She tells the story of the Tape family, a family, she says, and they, who were involved in the extraordinary invention of Chinese America, in her latest book, which is called The Lucky Ones. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.